Well, we've been exploring in a couple of sermons sacred text. Had a workshop that I was going to offer about that. Didn't happen, but you remember if you were here last week. If you weren't, I'll just let you know that Reverend Kathleen Rowlands built her sermon around the story of Jonah from the Hebrew Bible. And that's one traditional form of sacred text. A song like that one is another form of sacred text. It's got some amazing imagery that actually comes from Bruce Coburn's own, I think, Christian faith. Most sermons in traditional Christian churches use Bible texts for preaching. They preach from the Bible in the way that Reverend Kathleen did last week, because they believe with varying degrees of certainty and interpretation that that sacred text of the Bible is somehow the Word of God. Well, we bring a different attitude to the Bible in a church like this one. We use Bible texts and stories, but we don't treat the text as God's Word. We treat it as a human word about God, or about other matters of spiritual importance that is meaningful to the preacher. And if that personal meaning is able to be conveyed through a sermon, then for whatever it's worth to you in your own life, in your own meaning system. So because of this attitude that we bring to sacred texts, preaching from the Bible is not unusual in Unitarian Universalist churches, but we may just as often use scriptures from a variety of other religions, or texts from secular sources, such as novels or poems. And I've preached from rock song lyrics, too. But preaching inspired by one of the classic koans from Zen Buddhism doesn't happen that often. And that's because even though koans, like the one that we heard Joan read this morning, do sometimes contain stories that are very preachable, they are more often brief, enigmatic texts that raise questions that sound very contradictory or confusing. So, for example, does a dog have Buddha nature? This classic first koan in the Gateless Gate. And in that short koan, the teacher Joshu replies, "Mu," which is actually a word that can mean yes or no depending on the context. So what is mu? That's your first koan question if you do koan work. Because koans often sound like that, the popular understanding in the West by people who aren't that familiar with Zen Buddhist practice is that they are sort of like riddles that are being posed by the teacher to the student. And if the student can express the right answer, then they get the reward, which is something called enlightenment. But these understandings miss something that's very important about both koan practice and enlightenment, which is that neither of them are like this, short processes. They're really long-term processes rather than singular transformative events. The unique purpose of koans and what sets them apart from other kinds of sacred text in world religions is that they operate primarily and most importantly in a face-to-face teacher-student encounter. And they are understood as a vehicle for conveying a consciousness, a different way of being in and seeing the world. So in that sense, the attitude that Zen Buddhists bring to their sacred text is not unlike the overall attitude that we Unitarian Universalists have. A koan is studied not because it has a holy truth for the ages, but because it is a pointer to an insight that is there for each of us to realize for ourselves and not just accept as a revealed truth. So I've been doing a koan practice with three different Zen teachers for about 12 of the 25 years or so that I've been a Zen student. And I've worked with about 125 koans over that period of time. And if there's one insight that I can convey today about what is important and unique about koan practice, it would be this. In a world in which sound bites or tweeted opinions rule and problem solving is framed as black and white, yes or no, koans offer a different way of approaching this world, which is a both-and way, a way that challenges our binary thinking. What's binary thinking? It's the belief that everything in the world is either this or that. It's the belief if you're not one thing, you have to be another. It's the belief that effects have causes, or more particularly, one main cause. Now, in this world of everyday routine activity in which we live, these can all be very useful beliefs that can help us get around and get things done. Binary thinking is a tool, and distinctions are important ways of maneuvering in the world. But they're not very useful in understanding the deeper nature of reality or in responding creatively and flexibly to complex problems. So just to give one example of this, our culture has been undergoing a big challenge to binary thinking when it comes to gender identity. Growing up, never crossed my mind that gender was anything other than male or female. The diversity of gender expression that we see today in the public square was something unimaginable for me when I was a teenager, and yet it is something that I increasingly take for granted. Zen practice seeks to convey a non-dualistic experience of our common life, which can replace the usual and often unconscious foundations upon which we base our search for meaning. So when you sit with koans and talk with teachers about them, you're actually not supposed to do what I'm going to do this morning. You're not supposed to reflect on them intellectually. Nevertheless, even with experienced meditators, the problem becomes a little like being told not to think of a pink elephant. You know, you just can't help yourself if you're given that instruction. So the first time that I sat with this koan that was read this morning, a segment of that koan actually, called Baijiang's Fox, I went into this long mental excursion about the criminal justice system and how it works. That was the first place I went to when I thought about this koan. Now, why would that be? There are some issues in our society that feel like big tangled knots. And the more you pull on one side of a problem, the more tangled it gets in some other place. And I think our justice system is very much like that. And it's been the subject of a lot of scrutiny in recent years. I'm sure that some of you have read Michelle Alexander's compelling argument that the way that our justice system is operating really represents an extension of the culture that produced slavery and Jim Crow laws. And even as Alexander's book was drawing wide attention, highly publicized police shootings of unarmed people have thrown law enforcement into a self-examination, into a crisis mode, as long-standing practices within law enforcement are challenged and defended as to whether they're acceptable or not. My observations today aren't going to be so much about broad policy solutions. I'm not doing a lecture about the justice system. But I do want to hold up one alternative approach that I think represents a both-and way of approaching issues in criminal justice that is being used to unravel some of the knots in our justice system in smaller settings in our society. And I want to reflect, and it's called restorative justice. And I want to reflect on this as a reflecting the spiritual wisdom that's in this Zen koan, and reflect a bit on the questions that came out of the koan to unpack a little bit about how restorative justice works. The story, the koan, is a kind of a ghost story. I mean, you've got this old man sitting in the back of the zendo who identifies himself as a former abbot of this temple, literally a former incarnation of this very abbot who's been doing the teachings. And he is coming back to his own successor in this ghostly form, and he's pleading for help to be released from a karmic sentence of being reborn 500 times as a fox for giving his student the wrong answer. Koans aren't necessarily supposed to have right answers or wrong answers. It's possible to make the right mistake in answering a koan, and we'll explore that in a song a little bit later. But and the sentence that this abbot got, this ghostly abbot, was pretty severe, because in ancient China, foxes were very unpopular animals. They were like vermin. They stole from humans. You did not want to be reborn 500 times as a fox. You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of multi-generational underclass poverty as a sentence that afflicts people in our society that generates crime. It's a common, complex cause of where crime comes from. A line like that represents something. What was the wrong answer that this abbot gave that brought about this terrible sentence? The question was, does an enlightened person fall under the law of cause and effect? And the old abbot's answer was essentially no. The question and the answer suggests for me the hope that is held out by political candidates and reformers alike, that there will be policies and programs that we're going to be able to invent that will solve the problem of crime. You know, all the evidence that I see suggests that the human condition that our justice system responds to is not changing. And despite my belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every person, I also believe that we all suffer, and that therefore we are all susceptible to what Christians would call sin, maybe what Bruce Coburn would call the burden of the angel beast, that causes us to act in ways willfully that are seeking to relieve our suffering but that end up hurting others. That's really what crime is. The ghosts of our past lives and sins in this country and around the world are very much present in how our justice system is structured and what it has to deal with. And reforms in the criminal justice system are never going to create a perfect system or deliver perfect, enlightened justice. Nevertheless, there is hope. And this story tells us that the koan has more than one answer. The question that was asked in the koan has more than one answer. So things happen for a reason, but crimes happen for a lot more than one reason. We can certainly identify the person that pulled the trigger or the person that drove the car, and we can decide if they are, through a process of a trial, if they are guilty and therefore not innocent, and we can put them in jail. But that is actually little help in understanding the causes of the crime or how society makes it less likely that the crime will happen again. Law enforcement is only the tip of the spear in response to crime. And this, you know, metaphor of the tip of the spear, it's a military metaphor from ancient wars. And it reminds us that the tip of the spear is not responsible for knowing why it is being used as a weapon. The reasons that the spear has to be used at all are farther back in the complex chain of many causes that result in crime. So in this koan, what seems to be the better answer about cause and effect? And how was the ghostly abbot released from his sentence of 500 lifetimes as a fox? He wants to ask the question again as if he was the student asking his contemporary self the same question. And he is told, such a person does not evade the law of cause and effect. Does not evade. The first answer was what? Does not fall under. Right. Does not evade. Why do these words make such a difference in this story? And what does it say about how our justice and law enforcement system might be better? The word evasion means to avoid or shirk one's duty, especially through trickery or cunning. So the message here is that the response of the wise person reflecting on our justice system or its possible reforms or alternatives ways of doing it is not to evade, but honestly accept the complexity of the causes of crime and seek to unravel them by creating consequences for crime that not only punish but restore what has been lost for victims and that intervene somehow in what has been destructively tangled up for the criminals. Unless you actually work in the justice system, it's pretty easy for people who enjoy varying degrees of privilege in our social and economic system to be isolated from and evade engagement or responsibility. Our justice system arises as a response from a binary thinking public that wants to isolate those who are accused and convicted of crimes, and actually those who arrest, prosecute, and defend them from all the rest of us. They are all them, and we are all us, and us wants to feel safe and not to have to think about crime. Occasionally, we have experiences where one of us that might carry privilege or power has encounters with the criminal justice system that may help us understand what it means to be one of them. I've got to tell you, though, in my life experience and my experiences as a minister, my encounters with the criminal justice system have been primarily pastoral. I've visited a prisoner for some time in San Quentin. I've stood with parishioners who faced various kinds of judicial proceedings, and I've counseled law enforcement officers and criminal attorneys who have been members of the congregations I've served. But even these modest opportunities are far more than most people who have been involved in, or have escaped, I should say, multi-generational patterns of poverty will ever see. And as far as being a subject of the law enforcement system, being accused of something, my personal encounters with the justice system have been trivial, moving violations primarily. Like the one I got last month in Texas, 28 miles an hour in a school zone that I had failed to notice. So this enlightened person could not evade the cause of law of evade the laws of cause and effect. I was thinking about how many moving violations I've had in 50 years of driving. Probably six, I would say, maybe. And you know, as a polite white guy who sometimes gets to mention that I'm a minister, I've probably been let off with warnings from half of them, subject of a different sermon. But that didn't happen this time. How I looked and my privilege did not get me off. So I'm looking for the bad news on the traffic ticket, which involved like four pages of verbiage dealing with my options. And I realized that this little traffic ticket had an opportunity that most of us are very familiar with, for a different kind of response to the crime that I was accused of, a both-and response rather than an either-or response that represented what we might call restorative justice. So restorative justice happens out there in the criminal justice system. It's nothing new. Retributive justice asks what law was broken and how, who did it, and how should they be punished? Restorative justice asks different questions. It says, who has been hurt and what do they need? What are the causes of the hurt? Who has a stake in the outcome? And who has either an obligation or a desire to participate in a resolution and a healing process? Rather than focusing on isolating the criminal as other, restorative justice invites the possibility that paying for the crime involves entering back into the community of us through a process of personal confession, relationship, compensation, and restoration. So restorative justice inspired alternatives or supplements to the retributive justice system are both as old as all of the legal systems of the West, and as new as current contemporary cutting-edge experiments that are happening in Canada, in Europe, in tribal courts among indigenous people in the United States and in some parts of our own criminal justice system and in our schools. I'm sure you have heard of the most famous large-scale restorative justice experiment, which was the truth and reconciliation process in South Africa after apartheid. For 20 years, the Center for Justice and Reconciliation has run restorative justice experiments and programs on 5 different continents. And restorative justice approaches are most needed and most valuable and most used, I think, in the U.S. today in juvenile justice and in school systems, where early intervention in the tangle of causes for a crime is so crucial. Peer mediation in U.S. schools that use a restorative justice model when they're dealing with student crimes or conflicts are a new response to zero tolerance policies that have pushed children towards the criminal justice system and instead of trying to hold them out. I will tell you that the most difficult place to introduce restorative justice into criminal proceedings has been in crimes involving sexual abuse. Maybe understandable. Obviously, the severity of the crime makes a difference in both the legal and the spiritual difficulties in using this approach. The option that was available to me on my traffic ticket was easily implemented for this nonviolent minor offense. If I'd been a Texan, I would have had the opportunity to go to traffic school and have the moving violation expunged from my record. So this very simple form of restorative justice tries to make things right by going to one of the causes of the problem, driving habits that are ignorant or inattentive. Unitarian Universalists had an opportunity this summer to wrestle with a much more difficult application of restorative justice on the Sunday morning that concluded our General Assembly in New Orleans. Because that morning we heard that 2 members of our UUA staff had been attacked in the French Quarter by 4 youth. They had been pushed to the ground and robbed, and one of the staff members had hit his head so badly that there was a fear of permanent brain injury. And the entire robbery had been filmed by a security camera and was available on YouTube within 48 hours. Video of violence has become so commonplace, you know. We think we're immune to it, but when it crosses that sort of binary line and the violence that's being shown or done is done to one of us rather than one of them, the emotions that come up are different. So I saw that video and I was horrified, I was angry, and in my first reactive emotional response I went straight to revenge. The irony was that all of this happened the night after our Ware lecturer, Brian Stevenson, who some of you may remember I was talking about in a sermon last month, had spoken to us from his career as a criminal lawyer that defends those accused of capital crimes. And he had been talking about his belief in restorative justice. So the next morning, with broken hearts, we are confronting the difficulty of the spiritual aspiration to forgive and the reality of imagining what restorative justice might look like in this very common situation that had affected one of us. As the days and the weeks unfolded, we heard that the 4 young men who had committed the crime had either surrendered to law enforcement or been apprehended, and that Unitarian Universalists, in conversation with the victims and their families, had attended the judicial proceedings to try to understand more deeply how this had come about and what would happen next. Turns out that 3 of the youth who had been involved in the attack were living long-term in a homeless shelter and had essentially been in social services and homeless care ever since Hurricane Katrina, when they were probably between 3 and 6 years old. And they had never gotten beyond that, back to being in a home. And while it's true that these young men had made bad choices, and absolutely the worst choice, we also all realized that these are people caught in this tangle, and we're not easily going to be able to evade the cause and effect of long-term systemic poverty, racism, and homelessness as part of the story of this crime. So this story is not over. You may be reading more about it if you monitor UU Media. We continue to monitor the legal proceedings and whether these young men's lives get essentially thrown away, as happens so often with people like this who have their first encounter with the justice system, and what limited options there are to respond to them in a different way. So I continue to reflect on this tragedy, and I keep coming back to those four recommendations that I told you about last month from Brian Stevenson's powerful message to us at General Assembly the night before the attack. If we are going to have any impact in making the criminal justice system in this country better and understanding it better, we have to get proximate, that is, get into closer relationships with the communities that experience crimes and the people in them that are committing crimes. We should change the narrative about how the crime comes about. We should stay hopeful that there is a possibility for success in reform or in more restorative justice. And we have to be willing to do uncomfortable things, like hang in through a long judicial process and actually consider the possibility that some of us might be in relationship with these young men, as an example. Our Unitarian Universalist values call us to live in the reality of evil and heartbreak in this world while remembering that no one is outside the circle of love. They call us to live lives that are both and rather than either or. So these commitments lead us to question whether retributive justice is the only or exclusive way. No one wants a justice system that undermines the rule of law or that abandons a belief in personal responsibility or accountability. We can't evade the laws of cause and effect, but we can recognize the complex ways in which they operate. To quote Brian Stevenson and conclude today, simply punishing the broken, walking away from them, or hiding them from sight only ensures that they remain broken and that we will too. There is no wholeness outside of our reciprocal community.